Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, scholar Marilyn Sanders Mobley discusses her book, Toni Morrison, and the Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging, with poet Parnesha Jones. The following conversation originally took place October 15th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
We're here tonight to celebrate one of America's most important writers, thinkers, and scholars, the late, great Toni Morrison, identified by our supporters as their favorite writer last year at our annual gala. Morrison's work created spaces for her readers to connect with her characters and themes. Here tonight to talk about those spaces and Morrison's artistry within them are Dr. Marilyn Sanders Mobley and Dr. Parnesha Jones. In Dr. Mobley's new book, Toni Morrison and the Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging, she combines textual analysis with the study of Morrison's cultural politics and narrative poetics and describes how Morrison engages with both history and the present political movement. Informed by research in geocriticism, spatial literary studies, African American literary studies, and Black feminist studies at the intersection of poetics and cultural politics, Mobley identifies narrative strategies that illuminate how Morrison creates such spaces in her fiction, what these spaces say about her understanding of place, race, and belonging, and how they constitute a way to read and reread her work. Marilyn Sanders Mobley is Emerita Professor of English and African American Studies at Case Western Reserve University. She is the author of Folk Roots and Mythic Wings in Sarah Orne Jewett and Toni Morrison, The Cultural Function of Narrative, and a spiritual memoir, The Strawberry Room, and Other Places Where a Woman Finds Herself. Parnesha Jones studied creative writing at Chicago State University and earned an MFA from Spalding University. Her first book, Vessel, from 2015, was the winner of the Midwest Book Award. Her poems have been published in numerous anthologies, and she is the director of Northwestern University Press. Please help me in welcoming our special guest tonight.
Hello, everyone.
Yes, hello.
Thank you for coming in all the rain, and it is officially fall. And some other stuff, too. But thank you for coming out, and thank you for everybody online for tuning in. This is a really, really special thing in terms of honoring, you know, one of the great, not only writers, but I think orators of American literature. And it is wonderful to welcome you to town, Dr. Mobley. And so I think we're just going to get right into the thick of this, because I have a lot of questions for you. And anytime somebody asks me to come and talk about Toni Morrison, it's just like, I don't even have to know the context. I just need the address and I'm there. So
that's how I am.
So I'm very grateful to be able to sit and talk with you a little about her, but also your process as a writer, because you have a very storied career. And so can you start by talking a little bit about your arrival to the work of Toni Morrison and how her work and the things that she did as not just a writer, but also as an activist, also as a woman of color in certain spaces in this country. Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived to her work and how she influenced your own individual trajectory?
Thank you, Parnesha, and thank you everyone for coming and those online. I really like that question because it starts in kind of serendipity that I read her in a freshman literature class at Barnard and had heard about her, but read her, read The Bluest Eye, and saw references to Akron, Ohio, which is my hometown. And Akron is right around the way from Lorain, which is where she was born. So for the first time for me as a Black college student to see a reference to my hometown, to see references to Akron, to Isley's, I saw references that I recognized. And then the story itself just grabbed me about a Black girl who was experiencing what it's like, as Toni Morrison says, to be the most vulnerable member of the community. A Black girl is the most vulnerable person in the community. And to see that vulnerability that I felt represented in a novel. And the writing just was so powerful from that very first novel that I was just enthralled with her writing, with the subject matter and the way she wrote. And I didn't know everything that I'm now writing about her then, but I just knew there was a way she was using language and narrative that had my attention, and I just stayed with it. I just kept coming back to her. My bachelor's thesis was on Ralph Ellison. My master's thesis at NYU was on Ralph Ellison. But when it was time to do a PhD, I said, I'm coming back to Toni Morrison, because I kept reading her all along. And so I was ready to put together some of what I talk about in this book, how she talks about place. So I started with Akron, Ohio, you know, how she talked about places where Black people lived, how she talked about race. And I'm interested in what she says in an essay called Home, that she was interested in how to be a racialized subject. In other words, know she's a Black woman, and how to talk about how race matters and does not matter. And I was interested in how she was always navigating that space of it matters and yet it doesn't matter. And in one essay, in one interview, she says, racism is a distraction. And I just talked about this at another book event, and someone came up and challenged me and said, what do you mean it's a distraction? And I said, what she meant by it is, when you're reacting to racism, you're off your game. You're off what you're supposed to be doing, whatever your work is, whatever your passion is, you're off of that while you're dealing with that. And so she was only saying that as an artist, she's very interested in always helping people understand there's a distraction. So when I was writing this book, I was trying to pull together threads I had noticed as early as my freshman year, which we don't care when that was, 1970. As early as 1970, I was all the way back there and just thinking about what has Toni Morrison done over time that draws me to her language. I was telling Pranisha that every class I ever taught, once I heard the Nobel Prize lecture in 1993, I began every class with her Nobel lecture because I wanted my students to hear her talk about language and talk about narrative and the power of storytelling and what it can do. And, you know, I don't even want to start talking about that lecture now, but it's a very powerful lecture because it's an example of how prophetic a writer she was. The issues that we're talking about right now around immigration, around fascism, around racism, she talks about it in that Nobel lecture in 1993. So I encourage you to read it if you haven't read it or if you don't remember what she said. But I always wanted my students to know she took that moment, very powerful global moment, and talked about how we use language to create war and to create discord and to create violence and what we could do with language. Because in the middle of it, a group of children and an elderly blind Black woman create community. And so the book ends with, look at this thing we've done together. So I just have been amazed with what she's done for readers over the years. Right. Is that a long answer?
No, that's it's.
It is.
No, I don't think that if you get asked a question about, so we should just be straight now. If you get asked a question about Toni Morrison, I always feel like the only way to answer anything about Toni Morrison is a narrative.
Thank you.
Okay,
I'm relieved then. Okay.
Okay, so we're good with that. But we have a connection in some ways because we both have copies of that Nobel speech signed by Toni Morrison. It's on my shelf at home, and you have a copy as well.
I have it, and it's marked up, and I refer to it often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here's the thing. This is a two-part question. And with the book, with the geopoetics of Toni Morrison, the two words that keep coming up are spaces and places. And after reading the book and taking some notes in the book, I was kind of conflicted when I finished the book, because spaces and places, and I was thinking about spaces and places in terms of what we are born into, what we inherit, versus the spaces and places that we make for ourselves. And one of the things with Toni Morrison is that What your book, one of the major themes of your book is that she did create spaces not only for her characters, but for the readers.
That's right. That's right.
So the two-part question I actually have is starting with how much of your career, because you've had this pretty, you've been in education and activism, the administrative part of the academy, and specifically honing in to your experiences in the academy are so layered. And I feel you have had several frontline views, whether in the classroom, whether as an administrator. What are your thoughts about how the academy overall, and this is not to obviously minimize academic institutions and spaces, because they vary and are very unique.
True.
But can you talk a little bit, and especially the last seminar that you gave was about Toni Morrison and other writers as well, like Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Right.
Can you talk about your thoughts of how the academy overall is handling the ideas and questions and long overdue conversations surrounding race?
Boy, I like that question. So I appreciate you recognizing the different parts of my career, because that's partly why you all are just now seeing this book. So I started as an English professor. I began the African-American Studies program at George Mason, so that's moving into administration. I became associate provost at that same institution over educational programs, and that's when people first said, I went to the dark side, and I had never heard that expression. I said, what do you mean I went to the dark side? And so they explained what that meant. So moving into senior administration meant I had another purview, and then I was provost at Bennett, which is a HBCU in Greensboro, and then I was hired to be chief diversity officer at Case Western, where I just retired in 2021. So in all those places, I had to determine what kind of space I wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. So place is where you find yourself, but space is how you make meaning in it. And Morrison at one point said she was writing to create spaces for the reader. And I started to find that very interesting and also contradictory to what I was experiencing. I was meeting students, I was meeting people in the community who said, I love Toni Morrison, I got to a point and then I couldn't understand her. It was too hard to read her. Some people it was beloved, but what I find is because of the intersection of women's studies and African American studies, there's been a place for teaching Toni Morrison in the academy. I'm also discovering more and more seminaries are including Toni Morrison's work. I'm also a minister, I'm an ordained minister, and I have made references to beloved Baby Suggs has a sermon in the clearing. And so I have found that the academy has been open to how I wanted to historicize Black identity. You know, what has been the history of Black people? It has enabled me to talk about a lot of things by way of Toni Morrison's work. I'm also aware that the academy is contested space. There are new areas of contestation. You know, there are book bans. You're not finding these book bans on campuses as much as you're finding them in high schools and all the skirmishes around the AP exam and so on. So for me as a professor, I always said to my students, one of the things that Black literature did was challenge what had been called the canon. It helped us challenge the canon that didn't include any people of color, didn't include very many women. And so the evidence that those challenges were succeeding is you started seeing Toni Morrison on AP exams. So I've been very interested in all these discussions around book bannings. This space that we're in is a wonderful antidote to book bans. I just want to say that about the American Writers Museum. Being in a space like this is like heaven to me. But I think Morrison gave us some ways to talk back to banning, to discrimination in what could be taught, what was considered valuable, what was considered valid. And most of her writing was about speaking back to Black lives were not important. Women's lives were not important. In her mind, we were the stuff of literature. Mm-hmm. I love those interviews when people would ask her, well, when are you going to talk about white people? She said, you would never have asked that of Faulkner. You know, you never would have asked, when are you going to write it? Well, we can't use Faulkner as an example because he did include black people. But her point was, you wouldn't ask that of a white writer. When are you going to talk about black people? And she wanted that interviewer to know how absolutely racist the question was. But she also wanted her to know, there are white people in my book. And so Morrison's writing for me has always given me a space to talk about the issues that I think needed to be discussed in American literature, in world literature, in the academy, in the classroom. And so when I go back to The Bluest Eye, I don't know if you know how people talk about The Bluest Eye, but many people talk about it starting with "Quiet as it's kept." Many people say that's the opening line. But when you go back to the book, you discover that it begins with excerpts from a childhood primer. Remember how we used to have those books, those Skip and Dick and Jane primers? And it starts with a primer, a Dick and Jane primer. And I think that is just so powerful, almost clairvoyant on her part, because for black people, that's historical also, that we didn't have access to literacy during enslavement. And so to start her first novel with, where do we get access to literacy? Where do we start reading? And how are we, now I'm talking about we meaning Americans, mm-hmm. how are we acculturated into reading with Dick and Jane primers that leave out people of color? So I just thought, what a powerful way to begin that novel. And so all of these other moments I've had in my career, when I retired, the first thing I wanted to do was get back to this Morrison book. I'm not going to tell this audience when I began this book, but I had to come back to it and finish it, because these ideas have been percolating for a while. But that one I really need to deal with, because I always found people talking about The Bluest Eye begins with black vernacular, quiet as it's kept, which is a black vernacular expression, yes. You know, when people say something is quiet as it's kept, it means, well, I always like to use vernacular to say back to it, it ain't kept so quiet. But when I went back and started reading it, it's like, but the book doesn't really start there. It starts with this excerpt from a Dick and Jane primer mm-hmm. that means, as a writer, she wanted to look at reading. Mm-hmm. And she was always interested in reading. And so part of my book is talking about how do black people, how do we read our lives? How do we read our own lives? How are we the center of our own narrative, not just on the margins of other people's narrative?
It's so interesting. And before I go into another question, I do want you to read an excerpt from the book, but it's so interesting, just as a follow-up of what you're saying, because we're talking about these spaces and the interviewer asking her that question, well, when are you going to write about white people? I think back to Edward P. Jones being asked about, I kind of sometimes mirror Edward P. Jones and Toni Morrison. I don't know if you all have read The Known World, but I get so fascinated with those two writers in particular just because of the amount of characters in their work. And I remember an interviewer asking him, because there's a lot of female characters in his novel, The Known World, and the interviewer said, how is it that you're able to write from the perspective of a woman, like all these different women? And his response was, well, I have a mother. And I've been surrounded by women. And so it's very interesting in your response to that question, talking about, well, when are you going to write about the other? There's always this question of, when are you going to write about the other? And I think that that takes up a lot of space,
yes,
too.
Yes, it does.
And so you feel as a responsibility as a writer, because you want your work, I think, to a certain degree, to be universal. But there's always this pressure, this underlying pressure of, okay, I can write my narrative. One of the things, being a publisher and being an editor during the pandemic, I never seen so many manuscripts come in of somebody who now was locked away at home thinking they were writing the great American novel or their memoirs and decided to send it to me. And we are in the space now of, we want people to tell their stories.
True.
But then we are also in the space that challenges everybody's story, challenges individual stories. And everybody is kind of, there's a fear.
Mm-hmm.
There's an urgency, an authority to tell your story, but we also live in a viral life that threatens the narrative of the individual story. So I've always looked at writers like Toni Morrison, who just, they seem to be able to kind of levitate with the idea of spaces and places, but the idea of owning one's narrative and not having to be beholden to tell some other narrative. So
that's,
I just
right.
wanted to put that out there.
That's right. And she was very interested in telling stories she felt had not been told from the perspective she thought had not been shared. And she actually quoted James Baldwin one time and said that many of the male writers that she respected wrote, this is a quote from James Baldwin, they wrote as if they had a little white man on their shoulder sanctioning what they wrote. And she said she didn't want to write as if she had to answer to someone. She wanted to tell the stories that she needed to tell. And I believe she tells them so masterfully that all kinds of readers get in.
Yeah.
All kinds of readers enjoy her work and can talk about her work, and I think she was committed to that. But when she turned 70, I was president of the Toni Morrison Society. And on that occasion, she spoke, and she talked about reading, writing at first being a very almost self-centered world, you know, that she was just writing for herself. And she said, if there's something you want to write, just write it for yourself. And then she realized, oh, I guess I want readers. And then she realized, oh, she wanted critics. At first she didn't want reviewers, but she acknowledged she did want them. And then she said, I want scholars. So she wanted scholarship. And I feel in many ways, not that I owed her anything, but I felt that I wanted to try to do what she said, which is she wanted scholarship that wrote in a way that was worthy of the culture. She felt that some people were pandering to the culture as opposed to talking about the complexity of Black life and culture. And so I was trying to do that in this book. I was trying to go down a couple levels to not what does she write about, but how does she write? What are her narrative strategies? So that's what I was trying to do. And I picked four. I said one was discursive mediation between polar opposites. Near the end of The Bluest Eye, for example, she says, we thought we were beautiful when we were astride people that we thought were ugly. So trying to get between those types of polar opposites throughout. Then I talk about emancipatory spaces, where she talks about the third space of interiority. The exterior is what happened to you, what did people do to you? I think Morrison was always interested in what is your interior life? How do you dream? How do you love? How do you feel beyond what has happened to you? She doesn't ignore what has happened, but she was interested in the interior life, which you get in deep detail in Beloved. And then the other one was narrative remembery. Narrative remembery is the one related to Beloved. Beloved is structured according to how the mind remembers. And that's what made it complicated for some people. Some people wanted it linear, you know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And as I always say to my students, but the mind doesn't remember that way. You can be looking people in the eye, like we're looking at one another, and you can be thinking about yesterday or last night or last year or when you first read your first Morrison book. And so Morrison structures Beloved according to that. And then that last one, as I said, is Interrogations of Home. She had an essay called Home. She also curated an exhibit at the Louvre in Paris called The Foreigner's Home. And so I'm just interested in, throughout her book, She takes what we think of as domestic space, and then she just keeps broadening it. What is the national space like? In one of her last novels, Home, there is a character named Frank Money who doesn't want to go back south. The only reason he goes south is his sister is caught up in eugenics, and a doctor is literally butchering his sister. And so he comes back from the Korean War, and he ends up going home to the South, which is where he said he'd never go again, only to save her. And so Morrison uses that novel and his journey. She uses references to the Green Book. Do you all know the Green Book? Uses references to the Green Book. And so she really tries to show, what is it like for someone to go to war in Korea, come back home? And that book spoke to me because my dad fought in the Korean War. Yeah. But for a black man to come back home, and black people tell him, don't get it twisted, you may have come back home, but home is still the way you remember it. And so he was not planning to go south. So Morrison is dealing with all of those kinds of strategies to tell stories that I think have not been told.
Yeah, yeah. Would you mind reading, because we're going to get back to the idea of banned, that word banned, and also the word censorship. And I've been thinking a lot after reading your book, the idea of the cross sections between censorship and the spaces that censorship occupy. And especially within black literature, but her literature specifically. But would you mind reading just the excerpt, and we can go from there?
Thank you. This is second chapter. It's called Spatializing the Self, the Geopoetics of Emancipatory Spaces. I don't know why I have to take my glasses off to read. I begin with an epigraph from Catherine McKintrick. Deep space and the poetics of landscape add new contours to geographic inquiries, asking us to take seriously the ways in which spatial expressions are wrapped up in everyday struggles and critiques. And that's from her book, Demonic Grounds. When we reread Morrison's work through the lens of her geopoetics, particularly at the intersection of race and gender, we begin to see how she shifts the focus from exterior spaces, places, to the interior spaces of her black female subjects and their reading of the places in which they find themselves. She is mindful, as Shabazz argues, that space plays a role in the production of identities, as she writes, to mitigate the extent to which physical space is regarded as the sole determinant for how to represent the interior lives of her characters and their understanding of their subjectivity. Through discursive mediation between the exterior and interior, she creates a third space that is similar to what Kwashi refers to as a poetics of being. And I just want to say, in the title of my book, Be and Longing has a slash, because I'm talking about being and belonging. Where the focus is on the text itself, a choral subjunctive that exemplifies but does not plead, and that creates a quality of being, a manner, an aesthetic, and a feeling. Circuits in an atmosphere. In other words, Morrison creates characters who read the landscape between the binary oppositional terms set for their existence and deploys narrative strategies to engage her readers in seeing how her characters interrogate and imagine that in-between space as a third space in which to create a way to be on their own terms. Beginning with Sula, the protagonist in her second novel, who operated from her own imagination, and with Pilot, the griot and guide in her third novel, which is Song of Solomon, who, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. Morrison experiments with representing black female subjects outside of established, prescribed social norms. As suggested in the previous chapter, she uses the narrative strategy of in medias res to interrupt reader expectations and presuppositions and show how her characters navigate the confines of history, oppression, and marginalization, signified by binary oppositional structures and systems. But she goes a step further by representing the ways in which the interior life of her characters becomes a new location to explore Black subjectivity both politically and aesthetically, especially through the imagination of her characters. She creates female characters who imagine their lives outside the confines of their physical locations in time and space to emancipate themselves and to create new ways and spaces of being. Or, as Elizabeth Alexander frames it, they find ways of imagining the racial self unfettered, racialized, but not delimited. This chapter focuses on those emancipatory spaces as a manifestation of Morrison's geopoetics and how they illuminate themes of place and identity at the intersection of race and gender, being and belonging, not only in her early fiction, but also in the set of novels she refers to as the Beloved Trilogy, about excesses of love, that is, Beloved, Jazz, and Paradise. I'll stop there.
Wonderful, thank you. So that leads into, thank you for reading that excerpt, because I want to go back to the idea of what's banned and the idea of censorship, but also in what that chapter is covering, the whole idea of the idea of emancipation. Toni Morrison is one of the most celebrated writers in the world, and she's also one of the most banned writers in the world. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, of someone who takes this authority, especially in the ideas of place and space and what you just talked about there. I mean, is censorship, did you know a little bit of how she felt about constantly being put on banned book lists? But also, is censorship the new emancipation?
Wow, is it the new emancipation? I'm not sure how you mean that, but I do know she thought it was somewhat hilarious that her books were getting banned. And she actually talked about it. I was at a conference with her where she was the speaker, where she did that essay, Home. And she was sharing with us, she learned there was a prison in Texas that had banned Paradise. And she said they had gone through the trouble, the people in charge of this prison, the administrators of the prison, had gone through the trouble of identifying the passages that were problematic, but they didn't include the first line of Paradise. The first line of Paradise is they shoot the white girl first. That was not on their list of reasons why they banned the book. And so this was an audience of Morrison scholars. We laughed with her. We thought, well, what was that about? So she took banning as evidence of how powerful language is. And she felt that when her books were banned, that she was going to sell more of them, because readers were often going to find, well, why'd they ban it? Right, you know, it's like when you're a child, the books your parents tell you can't read, those are the ones you go try to sneak and read. Well, I'll just speak for myself. Maybe not you all, but those are the ones I had to go sneak and read. So she was interested in why anyone would do it. Mm. But she knew that some of her books had been banned. Two that I know have been banned the most are The Bluest Eye and Beloved. Mm-hmm. I spoke at I won't say the school, but I was invited to speak at a school in Cleveland, a private school. And the person who invited me was, I believe, head of the English department. And he said, I want you to come and talk. I believe it was to an AP class. Mm-hmm. But he said, I want you to know that some of the students are absent today because their parents didn't want them to read Beloved. So if she were here now, she would continually, I think, find it both hilarious and extremely sad that people are trying to control what people read. At the same time, she did say, she wasn't sure that every one of her books was appropriate for every age level.
Right.
So I think I felt that was a respectable thing to say. And, you know, she was a mother herself. And so She wrote children's books with her one son, with her son Slade, several children's books with Slade. But I think it was very honest of her to say, some of my material is adult material, and for maybe for high school students, but elementary school children, no. Maybe middle school children, no. So she was willing to make that concession, but banning books, absolutely not. I mean, she's written essays. I encourage you to read her, the last book of essays, The Source of Self-Regard, where she actually comes to the defense of a Eastern European writer about just how important the work of writers is. And that when things are very, very difficult, she says that's, in fact, we just named something at the Annisville Wolf Awards are in Cleveland every year. And they started a new symposium called When Writers Go to Work. I think I've said the title correctly. And her point is, when things are very difficult, that's the very moment when artists go to work. And in one interview, she was saying she talked to her editor, and it was around the time of one of the elections, and she was just crestfallen and didn't know how she was going to write. And this editor said, no, this is precisely when artists go to work. Mm-hmm. And so she said she stopped her own pity party and got back to work. So I think she would deplore the situation we're in now, where books are being banned and taken out of libraries. But, you know, spaces like this speak back to it.
Right.
And there are professors and there are scholars everywhere speaking against book banning. You know, when I first started hearing about book bans, I said to Reverend Otis Moss Jr., not the Otis Moss that's here in Chicago, which is his son, but I said to Otis Moss Jr., I said, well, we just need to go back to freedom schools, because freedom schools were where we decided when people are banning our children or not teaching our children, we'll teach them in other spaces. And many people still believe in that, you know, that there are other spaces where you can get the information, where you can get the history. And what's so beautiful about Morrison's writing is she takes you to the history, but she takes you there through the imagination, through the art. Mm-hmm. You know, I always wondered, how did Black women survive enslavement? If you were a mother, if your body is the site of production and reproduction, how do you survive assaults on your body? And my answer was Beloved. She wrote Beloved to say that's how. You have people like Baby Suggs, the preacher who takes the enslaved community to the clearing. And the clearing, if you know African-American history, is the same as a hush harbor. The hush harbors were places where the enslaved went, sometimes to plot resistance, sometimes just to console one another. And so I love the way Toni Morrison wrote that. That's a major section in the book. You find many people quoting it. I find history professors quote it, law professors, theologians, preachers quote it, but she takes them to the clearing away from the plantation, and she says, out here, love your mouth, love your hands, love your neck. When she says, love your neck, she says, they just as soon have a noose around it. So she's saying that there were members of the enslaved community who knew how to, who taught the community, the only grace you have is the grace you can imagine. And so even in a novel that's as horrific as that one and as difficult, there are lessons learned in it about how you laugh, how you dance, how you cry, because that's what they do in the clearing. They dance, they laugh, and they cry. She asks the men to dance. She asks the women to cry, and then the children to dance. And then she switches it all around. Mm-hmm. And so I think Morrison was really interested in how can literature be the space that helps us when times are difficult, mm-hmm. that heals, mm-hmm. you know, that heals from trauma.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that leads into, and just to go back to when I was talking about the idea of censorship being this form of emancipation, because it's usually, despite what race you are, when you're an oppressed people are oppressed, mm-hmm. it's resistance. Like Toy Derricotte, the poet Toy Derricotte says, joy is an act of resistance.
Yes, it is.
And this idea of her being banned. I'm sure she wasn't happy being banned, but like you just said, well, it causes more people to want to read it. And it's just like telling like a little kid, don't eat the candy. Don't eat the candy. If I turn around, don't eat the candy. They're going to want the candy
even
more.
But she said it also is evidence just how powerful language is.
Right.
And so why do you want to deprive readers of this thing that is really powerful? In the Nobel lecture, she says narrative is radical, creating us at the moment it is being created.
Right.
And so, you know, I hadn't thought about joy in the context of censorship, but there is a way you decide, well, I know I'm going to write it now. If it's that powerful that you're trying to ban it, I'm really going to start writing now.
Exactly.
Because I have something to say that needs to be said, and somebody needs to read it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you feel that Morrison, and especially in putting this book together, and we're talking about the idea of creating these spaces through the lens of Black voices, do you think as a writer, as a Black woman writer, she felt a responsibility to create just as many spaces that invoke joy in addition to the spaces that invoke trauma?
Yes, yes, yes. I don't know if you know jazz. So she said there was a trilogy, the trilogy of love. So Beloved was excesses of mother love. Jazz was about excesses of romantic love. And then Paradise was about excesses of love of God and how any of those taken to the extreme could be harmful. But the end of Jazz is just one of the most beautiful love scenes I've ever seen, about a couple. They've been through some really, as my son would call it, they've been through a rough patch. They've been through a rough patch of infidelity and, well, I don't want to go into all that because I'm trying to get to the joy part. But it ends with this couple under the sheets and not needing to say certain things because their love has reached this mature space. They don't have to say certain things and they don't have to do certain things. I just thought it was the most beautiful thing I had ever read. And then there's a playfulness in that book because the narrator, I always say, messes with the reader. Because you're reading, and you know what meta-discourse is, right? When the book talks back to you directly, steps out of the book and talks directly to you. And so she's talking about what Harlem is like, what kind of a city it is during the Harlem Renaissance. And then the narrator says, oh, but I don't really know what I'm talking about, and you shouldn't trust me. So, I mean, just a kind of playfulness with language. And then at the end of that book, the narrator comes back that way. You know, you thought I knew something about these characters. And she said, but I didn't really know what I was talking about. And then she says, look where your hands are now. And so as a reader, she's messed with you the whole book. So I think there's a kind of playfulness. Like I said, in the clearing, when she's with the enslaved, she says the only grace you can have is the grace you can imagine. And so just finding ways to encourage yourself. She has a lot of playful scenes, even in The Bluest Eye, about how the children play together with dolls and all. So I think when you read through her work, you find moments of joy. You find moments of laughter. You find where people heal. You know, so it's not all about, she wasn't interested in just talking about enslavement, for example. Right. I just happen to love the novel, Beloved, but I love what she's doing with that last novel. And I encourage people to read the last novel, God Help the Child, because she's talking about another character who was teased because of her color, but she maximizes it and finds love at the end. I mean, I'm a hopeless romantic myself, but she finds love after some very horrendous treatment by her own mother, and it gets into colorism, which is some topics that some people don't like to talk about, colorism inside the community, but she manages throughout to have, I would say, expressions of joy, and the ways in which people create spaces of joy despite what's happened to them. So
thank you. Again, thank you all for coming out. Thanks to the American Writers Museum. And I'm just going to end by saying this is going to be a book to reread, going over and over again, because this book, and thank you so much, Dr. Mobley, for writing this book, because you actually give a space for readers to come and rediscover Toni Morrison.
Oh, thank you.
And so congratulations on this book, and thank you so much for this evening.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.